Hey guys, John Polomy here, Actionable Intelligence. Today is Saturday, April 8th, and this is the weekly market update. The disclaimer, anything that you see or hear on this podcast or video is not to be taken as investment advice. I am not a registered financial advisor. I cannot give you personal financial advice. Everything that you hear on here is for informational purposes only. Please do your own due diligence and consult your financial advisor before investing money. Okay, so one of the, if you remember back to the base case video that we did like a month ago, or maybe a couple months ago now, where I said what I was having as my base case, and one of them was that I don't think we're going to have a soft landing, that we had this pop at the start of the year. There was some of this soft landing language going around. The Fed was going to guide us in, blah, 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 blah. And my contention was that the lag effects of the monetary tightening that took place over the last year, as we go through 2023, that was going to manifest itself because, you know, when you raise rates, that has a lag effect before it starts affecting the economy. And so I believe we're starting to see that. Just think back to this time last year where rates were. They were not even half, I don't think, where we are now. So rates were rising this time last year, but as we move through the year and rates moved higher, it takes a while for those things to percolate through the economy and have their full effect. And we're starting to see that now. You know, we saw the first tremors with the little mini banking crisis we had a few weeks ago. And, you know, people, it's the same thing with like employment. Employment's a lagging indicator. So a lot of people are fooling themselves by saying, well, employment's still fairly strong. Jobs are still growing. You know, all these stats that you hear, but that's the same thing. That's one of the last things that you will see as you enter an economic slowdown that will react, that will, you know, the unemployment rate will be one of the last things that goes up. It's a lagging indicator. And so I'm not an economist. I'm just going on things that I hear from other folks that I trust and that make good arguments. And just from my general knowledge of economics, I'm not a professor, but, you know, what we're seeing here is, again, we deal in probabilities and pattern recognition. And this is from the St. Louis Fed website. It's called FRED. They have all the data. I've talked about this many times in the past. But this came off Twitter. But you can see this is a chart of net percentage of domestic banks tightening standards for commercial and industrial loans to large and middle market firms. You can see in previous times, previous points in history on the chart that are indicated, and these were all significant events. This was the dot-com bubble. This was the great financial crisis. This was, of course, the pandemic. And what happened was the gray areas, of course, are areas where recessions happened, the period of the recessions. And you could see that when we were in financial crisis then, or when we had bank officers, bank managements tightening their lending standards, you saw that we've had, you know, pretty decent recessions in the past. Now, again, what this typically will lead to is a relaxing in lending standards that will be precipitated by the Fed reliquifying the system. So you see where we're at here, that we're getting to a point that in the past has been at least coincident with periods of recession. So I don't think, you know, we've seen the full effects, you know, especially with the little mini banking crisis we had. We've had more news of people in the banking sector tightening lending standards. We've had a lot of depositors take their money out and go into money market funds or short-term treasury bills. I just think there's a general, what do you call it? I wouldn't call it a seize up of the loan infrastructure or the loan mechanisms at banks, but definitely lending standards have tightened, and that does several things, right? That is the fact that the US is a consumer-based consumer spending-based economy that relies a lot on housing and things of this nature. We're just with rates where they are, we're not seeing the activity. We're not going to see the loan activity, okay? As things tighten, as fear levels rise, as people get anxious, they're going to be less willing to give loans. So again, we're not PhD economists like they have at the Fed, but we see patterns and we play probabilities. So this is something I like to talk about because one of the things that I'm waiting on is, I've shown the chart with the move index, the volatility index for bonds, which is off the charts, but we haven't seen the corresponding fall in bond prices, high yields specifically. And that's one of the things that I had forecasted as a possible catalyst for a recession or a financial crisis. Again, I was expecting as rates went up, as these zombie companies' cash flows become constricted due to the economy slowing down, their inability to service their debt would manifest in failures, business failures, or stress on their finances, such that they would be downgraded. And this kind of all goes into creating an environment where people are bearish and sell corporate high yield bonds. When people sell bonds, we talked about that last week, it's not a very liquid market. And if we get a lot of people selling, there won't be a lot of buyers, and interest rates go up significantly, and it presents an opportunity. We haven't seen that yet. But what we are seeing now, here's another indication of what I was talking about, is this US bankruptcy filings by month. And this is US companies that announced a bankruptcy between 1 January 1st, 2020, and February 28th, 2022. The filings are greater or equal to 2 million, or private companies where either assets or liabilities at the time of the bankruptcy filing are greater than or equal to 10 million. And you can see that the trend is moving higher. This is what we thought would happen. It's starting to happen now. The lag effects, rates were, Fed began tightening liquidity in this area. And as it's percolated through, now we're starting to see the lag effects catch up, right? It's like if you are overweight for years and years and years, or if you start smoking, typically you don't get lung cancer the first or second year that you smoke. Typically, it's a cumulative damage that at some point, decades later, something similar that's kind of analogous to what we're seeing here, right? The lag effects of the rate increases take time to work their way and cause the damage in the system. And now we're starting to see that manifest in these bankruptcies. So, again, not positive for the economy, not positive for job growth. Now, it's not off the charts, but if you look back to, when we had the COVID or the pandemic situation, you can see where we topped out there. Of course, the Fed and the government came in and did a lot of bailouts for people. I'm not going to get into all that, but you see that we're getting, this is getting pretty stressful now. So we'll see. This is, 3 months is starting to show a trend here, is what I'm saying. So again, we still haven't seen high yield blowout yet. Maybe it won't, but I did read an article where one analyst said that they may not blow out as far on this time because a lot of companies availed themselves of the opportunity to refinance further out at lower rates during the period of low rates that we've had for almost a decade. But we'll see. At some point, if you can't service your debt and your cash flows become constricted because the economy goes into recession, you don't really know until you know, right? No one knows who's swimming naked until the tide goes out. So I think we're starting to see that now. And again, here's the US manufacturing PMI index from 2008 to current. You could see these are previous times when we've had recessions. Any reading below 50 shows contraction in manufacturing. Now, of course, manufacturing as a percent of the U.S. economy is not as high as it was, say, 30, 40, 50 years ago. I think manufacturing is only like 15% of the U.S. economy. Nevertheless, it still has an impact, and it's showing you that, you know, this is contraction in manufacturing. That's not positive for employment, okay? So we see, again, pattern recognition. Other times when PMI was contracting like it is now, these were times where we had recessions or economic downswings. One of the things I did want to talk about, and the reason I wanted to talk about it, was because a lot of people have emailed me, and I did a kind of a write-up about it in the April issue of the Actionable Intelligence Alert newsletter. And what I'm talking about is gold, right? So gold has broached or breached the 2000 level again. And so I wanted to talk about it because it's become the new shiny object. It's getting a lot of press. A lot of people are attracted to it. So I will discuss it now, my thoughts. Typically, gold, in my mind, is driven long-term by interest rates, real interest rates. We've talked about real interest rates before. Real interest rates are determined by taking the inflation rate of the CPI. You can use the CPI, even though it's a flawed metric, and then you subtract that from the current interest rate, and that will tell you what the real interest rate is. And when real interest rates, what we've seen over time, there's a correlation between negative rates or rates going in a negative direction, and that being inversely proportional to the price of gold. So as real interest rates decline or go negative and stay negative, it has the effect of being bullish for gold. Now, I'm not going to get into the reasons why. It's beyond the scope of this weekly discussion, but suffice to say, that's, if you can go do some research on that. Now, there are other times when gold also moves, times of fear, economic fear, geopolitical fear. These are more short-term moves. And so, you know, one of the main ideas that we have here in the Actionable Intelligence Alert newsletter is the slow decline of the United States. Now, this kind of goes on line where you have people like, you know, I'm not going to name names, but as soon as you start talking about this, people will say, well, what time frame are you talking about? Well, the United States is in terminal decline. It's not going to happen in a year. There's a lot of, as Adam Smith says, there's a lot of ruin in a country, but the dollar is on its way out, okay? I don't know what will replace it. I don't know if it'll just be chaos. I don't have a crystal ball. What I can tell you is the debts, the ability to service them, the impending tsunami of entitlement spending with respect to Social Security and Medicare are just simply going to overwhelm the United States government, federal government's ability to pay these, to deal with this. No one is talking about doing it. No one's talking about dealing with it. Now, again, these things don't really matter until they matter. You can go along for years. They don't, everybody, I remember reading a book in the early 90s by Harry Figge. He was a CEO of a company called Figge International. He wrote a big book about the debt problem. You had Bob Dole talking about bad debts when he was a senator, or debt levels. These things don't matter until the market decides they matter at some point. And then they matter. Everything can change within a weekend. So I think, you know, with the geopolitical instability we have, with the United States regressing economically vis-a-vis the rest of the world, as the United States becomes a smaller and smaller proportion of global GDP, as it has all of its other problems, which I'm not going to get into. That's not to say the rest of the world's wonderful in a Shangri-La, but, you know, I think you're seeing, you know, more people, all these people that were holding US treasuries are not so keen to hold them anymore for reasons we've talked about before. If you antagonize the US or don't do the US's bidding, they've shown that they will violate inter they'll violate, precedent and seize your assets, and there's nothing you can do about it. And so that encourages people, especially regimes or countries that, are supposedly enemies of the United States. Why would they want to be associated with the United States financial system? So what I'm trying to get to, long story short, is gold being a way for many countries to diversify themselves away from the US dollar, from the US financial system. Now, you can't, a country like China or whatever can't just take all of its foreign reserves and put it into gold. It's not possible. But they can slowly over time increase the amount of gold they hold. It's just like a person, right? If you hold physical gold, you have no counterparty risk. And that's the same thing with a country or foreign central bank. You don't have to worry about the United States government or anybody, confiscating your wealth because you're exerting a certain foreign policy that the other party may not care for. Or whatever. So what we're seeing is, another catalyst for gold, I think, is going to be the continued emergence of this multi polar world that we seem to be moving to, where countries are going to shy away from US Treasury securities and the dollar as much as they can. Now, of course, the dollar still dominates global trade, and it will for many years. But I think over time, it's going to shrink over time. And these countries are going to do slowly but surely try to wean themselves away from the United States as much as possible so they don't find themselves in the situation that Russia found itself in, where it had, $300 billion of its assets confiscated by the United States with no legal recourse. So, irrespective of what, if you think it was proper or not, that's, people watch what other people do. If you're, so that's why you're seeing, I think, a lot of this continued move away from the US and move away from the dollar by a lot of these developing countries. And so that's what you're seeing, right? Central bank demand has had the strongest start to a year since at least 2010. So you see central bank gold purchases are pretty strong. So we'll see how this goes. This is just a one-off, or if things calm down and then everybody becomes friends again and everything goes back to the way it was, we'll see. But I think this is another catalyst for the gold price. We've seen little anecdotal discussions around gold in retail that, some of the largest volume for retail investors buying gold bullion, things of this nature. Look, let me just speak very quickly to gold and what I think about it, and speak specifically to junior mining stocks, because this is what people really want to hear about. They want the quick buck. They want to get rich. If gold's going to move, then how high is it going to go? And what's that mean for, me being buying, Moose Pasture Gold Company in Saskatchewan? So I believe that people should own gold and silver bullion and hold it in their possession, however you choose to do that. Gold and silver physical bullion are not really bought. I don't consider those purchases for capital gains or for investment purposes. I believe that holding precious metals is insurance, it's savings. It's a way to ensure your wealth, your time, the years of your life that you labored, energy that was invested into things. It's shown that it's able to maintain its value throughout history. Because regardless of what the dollar milkshake people say, or Peter Schiff says, or anybody else says, every paper currency, every unbacked fiat currency in the history of the world fails, and the US dollar will eventually be replaced also. It's just a history. It's just the one certainty. Okay, now the timelines, I don't get into that. That would be a mug's game. Again, like Adam Smith said, there's a lot of ruin in a country. But what I can tell you is that gold and silver bullion, particularly gold bullion, gives you insurance against central bank and government malfeasance. What do I mean by that? Well, how do you think historically governments solve their debt problems and their problems like they have with, these impending entitlement tsunamis and these pension schemes that cannot be paid? Well, I will refer you to conversations. You can go back in time. They're very interesting. You can look them up on YouTube. When Ron Paul was a congressman and they would bring the Fed chairman in to talk, he had some very interesting question and answer sessions with former Fed chairman Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke. And I remember a conversation with Alan Greenspan when Congressman Paul asked him about the dollar being a fiat currency, the debt problems, the mathematics around the Social Security and Medicare insolvency that's staring us in the face. And Mr. Greenspan responded very calmly and very correctly. He said that the Federal Reserve, the US Treasury, in conjunction, the government, if you will, of the United States, has the ability to guarantee that all of those commitments will be paid. And then he paused. And then he said, I'm paraphrasing, but you can watch the video. Then he said, however, we do not guarantee the value of the dollars that we will have to create basically to pay those bills. So they will pay your benefits. They will pay the obligations. What they will pay them in is in depreciating currency units. And that's what gold protects you against. If you're in a situation like 1938 or 39 Germany, and you're trying to cross borders, and because you're of a particular political or religious persuasion, and you're trying to get out of a country that possibly is going to persecute you, these metals throughout time have shown that they've been able to grease the wheels and allow for that. They're transportable. They're not gold's not destructible or doesn't there's fu like I'm not going to There's reasons why gold is used as money throughout history, why it's always been that way. And so that's what it protects you for. Now, when you talk like that, people get it. They start laughing. Again, I've talked about the Ray Dalio video, which you can watch also. Maybe I'll look these videos up and put links in the show notes, where he talked about holding gold and silver for the exact same reason. And this was, this is one of the top hedge fund managers for many decades. And he was saying this seriously, and people that were in the audience listening to him were laughing because that's how people look at gold and silver. It's a barbarous relic. It has no use. It's a doorstop, blah, 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 blah. And here you have Ray Dalio saying the exact same thing because he's not historically illiterate. You don't want to be without insurance when you drive your brand new F-250 off the lot and get in an accident a block away from the dealership. You'll be responsible for the payments. You don't want to try to buy insurance for your house after it's set on fire. You have insurance. You have it because it protects you against financial ruin. So that's why people should have a certain amount of bullion as protection. That's my recommendation. Now, people like to speculate in gold and silver junior mining stocks. I will tell you that I have been in this game for many decades, and I have a very inconsistent record in making money in junior gold and mining stocks. And I will tell you why. First of all, mining is a horrible business and it sucks. No one with a they're in their right mind would go into the mining business, any type of mining business. It's most of the time it's a net destroyer of capital, fraught with all kinds of disappointment. You have to, one in what, 1,000, one in 2,000 projects actually ever makes it into production. And what happens a lot of times is the project will have to go through two or three cycles sometimes, and then the third entity, company, person that gets involved with the project after two other companies busted out is the one that gets the benefit. I've seen projects that were bought for $5 or $10 million after at the bottom of a mining cycle that had had $50, $100, $200 million invested in the project for drilling and finding a resource. But as the price dropped for the commodity, it made it, it bankrupted the previous company and the thing was just liquidated. So you not only have those issues, you have the issue around, especially in the West now, you have risks around permitting, First Nations, environmentalists, NGOs, financing, operational risks, supply issues, the whole gamut. As one person said, I think it was Doug Casey, said once, everybody's trying to wreck the project, okay? From the government to your own people in your own company, suppliers, not deliberately, but it's just an industry, it just sucks as a business. Now, there are times when the price of commodities go up. We've talked about why that is. And then these things become very profitable for a short period of time, and they have short windows of opportunity. And so that's when people like to get involved in these things. I'm going to tell you a little secret about how you are successful in the junior mining stocks, okay? And for most people listening to this, you'll never be successful in them. This is how you become successful. You need to go to all of the mining shows in Vancouver. You need to move to Vancouver. You need to have a substantial bank account. And then you need to cultivate relationships with broker-dealers, newsletter writers. I could give you the names, but I'm not going to because I don't want to embarrass people. And then what will happen is if you're known to have money, then you need to research who all the players are that have been successful in mining promotions. And then once you're known, these people will include you. You'll be offered to buy into different deals. And how this works is, and I'm not saying they're all cheats or cons. There's a lot of con men and a lot of cheats there. But some people have legitimate projects. And so you'll be offered the opportunity to participate in a private offering. And so you'll get like founder shares. You'll be able to buy shares for, okay, we're going to raise, $5 million. We're going to create this company. We're going to get this mining executive that was successful, this development person, blah, blah, blah. Put a team together. They've had previous success. We're going to get this other project off the shelf. It's, whatever, or we're going to, it's greenfield, whatever, exploration. And then you're going to get a share, like 10 cents a share, 20 cents a share, and you're going to get a warrant that's good for, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And then what happens is that they get the company up and running, and then people start promoting the company. Newsletter writers, podcasts. What do you think all these newsletters and podcasts are for? Okay, that you're listening to. I'm not going to mention the names. They're always bringing people on. They're promoting these mining stocks. Did you know that a lot of newsletter writers and people that have podcasts, when they promote these things, they get shares? Not everybody, but it does happen. So the promotion happens. You get the push. It's called, you got to get the push. They have certain promoters have what they call the four P's, right? Property, people, price. One of the things is push. Who's promoting it? Who's pushing this? You got a big name in there. I'm not going to mention the names. You can do this research. Then the price goes up because there's a lot of, hype behind it. And say the thing goes from 20 cents to a dollar or 50 cents or 80 cents. Then all these people that bought their founding shares at 10 or 20 cents, they sell out to the retail people, okay, that have come in listening to these podcasts or getting, jazzed up or juiced up when they go to these mining conferences. And then these accredited investors are still holding the warrant. If something good happens and they develop a mine, they still have the warrant, okay? But they get their original money out, typically with some type of profit, and then rinse and repeat, go on to the next deal. And then they build up the stash of warrants and or shares. And, this is how it's done. This is how the real money is made. Is it possible as a small retail investor? Yeah, if you have a background in geology, if you want to devote and turn it into a part-time job where you're spending, 40 hours a week analyzing drill results, things of this nature, it's possible, you know, but going into it as just the general schlub retail investor, generalist investor, more than likely you're not going to get the results that you think. Okay. You're going to be told a lot of stories. And that's why I encourage people, get on a plane and go to Vancouver and go to one of these shows. Go to the Denver Gold Show. Go to some of these where they have all of these mining companies. They'll have 100 or 200 of them in a big hall. They have their displays and walk down there. Every single one of them has a story about how they're going to be successful. But if you go in there with the mindset that only one out of 1,000 of these things is actually going to develop into a mine, and that's no guarantee either that if it does develop into a mine that the people are going to be successful. Remember what the original Paladin story, okay? John Boshroff built Paladin, and then the thing went bankrupt because he brought it online at the top of the cycle. So all the work he put in, you know, I don't know how he came out of it, but you know, I know Rick Rule became very wealthy from it, and so did that contractor in Australia. So you need to understand that these are like, I hate to use these Doug Casey cliches that he's, you know, I don't, they're not cliches, but his sayings, but these are trading sardines. They're burning matches, okay? If you get a double or a triple off one of these things, you need to sell. What happens is people, it doubles or starts to go up, and then they say to themselves, well, the story makes sense. And then they start thinking about, well, this is the next, you know, whatever, you know, they start comparing it to. And, you know, if it's up 200%, well, why couldn't it go up 2,000%? I'm going to hold. And then inevitably what happens is there's a downturn or something, bad news happens. The thing craters 50%. And then they start, you know, you start bargaining and rationally, well, it'll come back. This is just a temporary setback. This is what happens to a lot of retail investors. So if you're going to get involved in this, you need to know how it really goes on. I'm not saying that Mark Twain's advice that a gold mine is a liar standing next to a hole in the ground is true in all cases. There's a lot of top-notch people in this business. There's a lot of people that know what they're doing. There's a lot of people that are sincere and have the best intentions, but there's a lot of jagoffs and con men also. There's a lot of people that just raise capital and tell stories. And then, you know, which I don't want to get into, you know, how, but I just gave you a flavor of how the Vancouver daisy chain works. And if you're not in, you're not, it's like George Carlin, it's a club and you're not in it. So if you have the ability, if you have got a lot of cash and you want to move to Vancouver and get your name out there, people will bring deals to you and you can probably get into that inner circle eventually. But as a regular retail Joe, that's probably not going to happen. Now, if you have interest in this, you want to turn it into a hobby and you want to do all the research and you want to study, then you could probably do better than the average bear. But most people, my advice is to stay away. Does that mean that, you know, or if you feel that we're going to have a move in the gold price, then just buy the ETF like GDX or GDXJ. Don't try to get too cute with it. But that's not, people don't want that. People want the 10 baggers and the 20 baggers, and they hear the legend of whoever, and there was a 50 bagger. Well, they should also watch the movie about Briex with that Matthew McConaughey. I forget the name of the movie, but that was a pretty good movie describing what the Briex scandal was. It was a massive mining scandal about 25 or 30 years ago. It was fascinating. So my advice is there's a difference between buying gold bullion and buying the mining shares. And there's times to buy the mining shares, but I'm talking about like the bigger ones. But your best bet is, like I said, if you think that gold's going to go from 2,000 to 3,000 or something like this, then your best bet is to buy these things instead of an ETF. And then you don't have to do the research into individual companies. Will your returns be as good? No. But more than likely you'll have better chance of success. Now, having said that, I also think there's ways to make money in these things by proxy. And in this month's newsletter, I talk about a company that I believe is going to have success because of the fact that we are in a full swing upcycle in mining in general. And in particular, I think gold will do well and copper. This particular company provides services to that industry to help that industry be successful. And again, that's not a company that's going to go up 10 or 20 times, But I think in the context of being inside of a multi-year upswing in spending for exploration and development because of the underinvestment we've had in mining, just like we've had in in oil and gas, the same thing happened in mining, that this particular company has the ability to tag along. I told the story before, even in the newsletter, I talked about this. I'll tell it briefly here. Levi Strauss, the guy that had the famous blue jeans that everybody wears, made his initial money during the 1850s gold rush in California. But he did not make his money by engaging in, he wasn't out panning for gold or trying to build a gold mine. He was a dry goods salesman. He had a store and he sold dry goods and mining equipment, basically. And so he supplied the requisite tools and clothes and things of this nature. And then he hooked up with another dude and they created this work clothes or whatever. You can read the story online, you can look it up. But that's another way I think that you can profit. And that particular pick this month in the Actionable Intelligence Alert newsletter is the way that I am playing it. Now, that doesn't say that I don't have some holdings in some junior mining companies. Yes, I speculate in them, but with a very, very small amounts of money. Okay, with the caveat, just like I do with angel investing, that this thing can go to zero. Okay. And so what I do is I buy a basket of these things that I research or that I get turned on to by people that I trust that know what they're talking about. And like I said, I'm not putting it all on one horse. You spread it out 10 companies, just like I do with angel investing. I'm probably in close to somewhere between, almost 50 to 75 deals. I can't even remember. And so you're hoping that the one or two out of that are the ones that rocket ship, make up for all of the losses, and still give you a market beating return. So that would be my advice. Most people won't take it. They'll still speculate. All you have to do is go on the message boards, like on Stockhouse, and look up these junior mining companies, and you will see the true believers on there. They get married to these things, they get emotionally invested in these things, especially if they buy them and then get a profit in them. These things can do no wrong. I've been down that road when I was younger, to get rich quick, swing for the fences mentality. Unless you're going to, like I said, turn it into a full-time job, or you got a big bank, big checking account that you can write checks and private placements, your chances of success are low. So that would be my advice when it comes to messing around with gold mining stocks. Going on with gold, what we're seeing is gold-backed ETFs have added ounces recently after almost a year of outflows, which is positive. Again, gold, if it gets into a bull market. Now, I will tell you that if you look at the longer-term chart of gold, I'm talking about monthly chart, last 5, 10 years. There's an interesting technical formation called a cup and handle that appears to be forming. These typically are very, very bullish. I do believe that in the context of a general commodity bull market, which I am forecasting for this entire decade, that gold will participate in that. However, I cannot give you the exact timing. I will say that, why couldn't it go to $3,000 or $5,000 an ounce by the end of the decade? Why not? Other people have said it can go higher. If you want to listen to somebody like Felix Zuloff or even the guys at Goring and Rosenzweig, I mean, I think I've heard Lee Gehring say it could go to $10,000 an ounce this decade. So I do think that if you have a general commodity bull market, that gold and silver will participate in that. I think for my money, I still think that copper is probably the metal that's probably going to do the best this decade, for the reasons we've talked about before. And again, the company that I'm talking about not only helps gold mining companies be successful, it helps copper mining companies be successful. So if you're interested in learning that name, you can take a subscription to the newsletter and understand where we're coming from. Talking about that, I do think resources and emerging markets or foreign markets are going to outperform the US one of the re in the next several years. Just because of the fact that we still, this is the just because we remain overvalued in the US stock market, or at least what you could call fairly valued, but at the limit of being fairly valued. This is the Buffett indicator. This is what Warren Buffett said once was his favorite indicator, which is the market capitalization of the US stock market with respect to the US GDP. And so what they've done here, and I will put a link to this site that tracks this, it explains how this indicator works. Now, again, Buffett kind of pulled back from that because he didn't want to give the impression this was his only tool for valuation purposes. But they call it the Buffett indicator because it's been fairly good at determining when the market is overvalued or undervalued. And what you see here is you see this historic trend line. You see this going back to 1950 in this particular chart. They have it several different charts on the website that I'm going to include in the show notes. But they show it as standard deviations from the historical trend line. And you can see that there's been periods when the stock market has been historically undervalued. And that was like from the last period of high inflation into the basically in this area when rates were very high. Interest rates, this is when Reagan came in, deregulation and rates went down. Then you saw that the market basically bottomed and made its slow increase and then went parabolic into the tech bubble. And you see that it was two standard deviations, which they call strongly overvalued. Basically, if you study this chart, you could see the periods in the past. Again, we're back to pattern recognition again. Okay. And we see that when things become overvalued with this indicator, like back here in the late 60s, early 70s, and around 2000, and now currently, that there's a period of where this has to revert to the mean, which is here. But typically, when you have a massive move to one side or the other, you don't just revert to the mean and stop. You go past the mean and then go historically undervalued in this case. Okay, which is the same thing here. You were historically undervalued in this area, which went on for years, by the way, and then became, you know, the reversion to the mean didn't stop right at the mean. You then became overvalued. So I would suggest to you that what I'm trying to, the point I'm trying to make here is that you probably can expect, as Jeremy Grantham has talked about also, the rest of this decade of not being very positive for most US stocks, the returns that you can anticipate probably won't be that high as this indicator as the overvaluation in the US stock market is squeezed out as you see the reversion to the mean and then eventually what I suspect will be a you know back to an undervalued basis. Again, we don't typically just go to the mean back to the mean and stop and then go back up again. We typically go overcorrect after we have extremes. So basically, you're just on that from extreme to extreme, but it can take decades. I mean, here's 1970 to 19, you know, to 2000. That's 40 years. Now, that doesn't mean you can't make money in there in those times. There'll be stocks that do very well. Value stocks will probably do well. But I would suggest to you that you should study this because the idea is that, well, you know, the Fed's going to cut rates and then we're going to go back to the way it was. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think things that have underperformed for the last decade will probably have their decade in the sun. And that's why I am looking at places like resources, commodities, certain emerging markets, and developing markets. So this is something to keep an eye on. Again, we want to buy things that are cheap and that are going from being undervalued and going back to at least to the mean and that hopefully overshoot. So getting back on oil, This is from Shubham Garg. He's a White Tundra. This is they have a website. This guy does a lot of presentations on Twitter Spaces about individual companies, the oil market in general. He's a good Twitter follow. I suggest that you follow him on and listen to his analysis. He's a very smart person. But what he's talking about here is that forward-looking flight schedule showing a 10% increase in global seat capacity, which equals 700,000 barrels a day of growth in jet fuel consumption over the next 11 weeks. Basically, what you're seeing here is the total seats being, airline seats. Here you have the years. So 2019 pre-pandemic. Obviously, this is the worst year of the lockdowns. Then 2021, then 2022. The view is that this will recover to the historical norm. In many places, it's already recovered to the historical norm and is above it, is growing again, i.e. India. So we still can be looking at just returning to the historical 20 pre-pandemic 2019 levels of air travel. That gets another 700,000 barrels of jet fuel demand. So something to keep in mind and track, which we have been tracking and talking about. Before we move on, one of the things I didn't really talk too much about the OPEC cuts. We have to wait and see what happens. There's been a lot of discussion about, well, Russia said it was going to cut 500,000 barrels, but they've only maybe cut 100,000 barrels, blah, 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 blah. We don't really know what's happening. And again, these things happen with a lag too. If the cuts aren't supposed to take effect till May, you've already loaded tankers or traveling, blah, 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 blah. So all this stuff takes time to work itself through, right? So again, a lot of people are saying that they're disappointed in the reopening in China. I'm not. I mean, the international flights just restarted in the last week or two. So you got to give time for these things to get back to somewhat normal, and then we can see what the real effects are. I wanted to show this. It says here the world invested over $1 trillion in clean energy last year. Here you are. It says Bloomberg data show clean energy investment matching fossil fuels. And I put here what could have been. This is $1 trillion last year. If you add all this up, somebody mentioned the fact that we could have built 660 1,000 megawatt nuclear power plants for that same amount of money instead of building the rebuildables. And can you imagine if we would have built 660 or even half that nuclear power plants of 1,000 megawatts? I mean, it would probably transform the world. I think eventually we're going to get there. Eventually reality sets in. Eventually common sense sets in. Winston Churchill had a saying, I think, during World War II, or maybe it was before World War II. I think somebody was asking him about the United States and how it was his lamenting about, the United States didn't want to get involved with different, upcoming things that were happening in the world with Japan and Germany prior to World War II. And I think that he said something, the United States will do everything, will eventually make the right decision after it tries all the other. Basically, you'll do the right thing after it tries everything else, or something to this effect. Well, that's basically what's going to happen in energy, is my forecast. This renewables experiment is going to be attempted by at least the West. I'm not going to argue the point anymore. Eventually, people are going to figure out it doesn't work. Just because of the fact that the cost is not going to, it's no, there's no Moore's law in solar panels or windmills, the intermittency, all the things that we've talked about before. And then people are going to say, the best bet is nuclear. And if the United States and Europe don't want to do it, well, the rest of the world will do it, because that's, if you want energy security, if you want reliable, cheap power, that's where it's at. Or build coal plants, but people don't want to build coal plants because of the pollution. And so, if you want clean energy, again, if you want to advocate for clean energy, if you want to advocate for less carbon emissions, there's only two ways to do this. You have to constrict human activity so they can't emit carbon. You have to lower the population so that less people are emitting less carbon, or you need to build a lot of nuclear power plants. You have to lower people's standard of living, restrict what they can do, restrict what they can eat. And we're going to talk about that because there are countries talking about doing that. Or you can build nuclear power plants and have a plethora of cheap energy available to you, which I think would open up all kinds of other opportunities. And I think the majority of the world will go that route. So here was a tweet that, again, we've talked about this before, but it really, when you see these things visually, it kind of impresses upon you. You know, one of the better performing sectors of the Actionable Intelligence Alert newsletter over the last year or so has been both the tanker stocks that we've owned. And one of the reasons that we like them is because it's a supply and demand situation, right? So what's a VLCC? This is a very large crude carrier. These are your very large crude oil tankers, 2 million, 3 million barrels, something in that nature. These are the new build order. So this is every year. This is the total amount of vessels that are supposed to be delivered each year. And then these are the years that they were ordered. You can figure that out over here. But what you see is we have 23 VLCCs being delivered this year. But going forward, we've only have over the next 4 years, we'll only have two ships being delivered. Now, again, these are, you know, entropy plays, you know, a factor here. You can only run these ships for 20 to 25 years and then they become, you got to scrap them. And so you're not replacing the fleet. You know, the fleet build as a percent of the fleet is at the lowest it's ever been almost. And so this is another supply demand issue. And so the view is, well, why is this happening? Why isn't anybody ordering any ships? Well, the reason is because why would you make the investment when these things cost like $150 million, something like that or more? And there's reluctance to make these investments because, first of all, you don't know what crude demand is going to be. Everybody keeps saying that we're going to, you know, zero emissions and that fossil fuels are going away. Plus, there's the International Maritime Organization still doesn't have all of its rules on emissions from shipping squared away yet. So you don't want to make a big investment in a ship and then have the wrong propulsion system and then have some issues with your emissions. Then you have this 25-year asset that maybe is immediately obsolete. So that's to the benefit of the current vessels on the water, because I don't believe that crude demand is going to peak anytime soon. As a matter of fact, it's going to continue to grow for the near future. And you have the same amount of ships or less ships because every year you're having to scrap out ships. We've talked about this before. You can't just keep vessels on the water indefinitely. As they age, they get to a certain... Now, there are rogue operators like Iran and Venezuela and Russia that, you know, are going to keep running these things as long as they can. But if you're in a normal, you know, country or party to these organizational agreements, about getting proper certifications and things of this nature, the things just wear out. And I mean, if you've ever been on a ship before in the ocean or served on one or worked on one, it's constant battle against entropy. You know, the elements are trying to rust the ship away. The machinery wears out. You can get the point here. So you have to constantly rebuild the fleet. If you don't, the supply of crude tankers is going to decrease over time, but the demand is not going to decrease. And then again, if you add more longer and voyage miles, ton miles, because that you've now discombobulated the world shipping industry because of all these sanctions against Russia, then it creates more demand. And these are the not accounted for circumstances. And this is why investing in shipping has been very, very lucrative, and I think will be even more if this continues, because if no one's building ships and replacing the ones that are wearing out and the demand for the tankers is going up and they have to travel further, more ton miles, well, you can figure this out for yourself. This is why we're seeing tremendous upward movements in shipping rates for both clean and dirty tankers. So this is why I continue to remain bullish until I see all these people come out. You know, they have so much cash coming in now. That's why we're seeing, you know, debts being paid down. We're seeing increased share buybacks. We're seeing increased dividends. And at some point, somebody's going to get a wild hair and say, I want to start buying some ships. When I start seeing that, then I'll become, that's when I'll be looking to sell. Until then, as long as rates stay well above the averages that they've been, which they are, they're depending, I mean, they're substantially higher than they have been over the last 10 years. We're in a tanker bull market. So, you know, ride the wave. So I wanted to talk about this. I will put this in the show notes so you can read it yourself. There was a paper that came out. It's called Absolute Zero, I think, or something like this. Anyways, this is from the UK. And this was a UK government sponsored NGO, I think, talking about what has to happen and some of the timelines. It's pretty good because it goes through everything, agriculture, aviation, manufacturing, and what needs to happen between like 2020 and 2029, 2030 and 2039, and then once you get to 2050. And I just have a few samples here for your pleasure. I'll put a link to it. You can look at it yourself. This is what these people want to do. This is where the West is heading. This is a paper in the UK. Again, it was funded and sponsored by the UK government. This is where they're taking you. So when you hear these counselors lie to you and say, no, you don't understand 15-minute cities. That's not what you think it is. Look, this is what these people do, okay? They lie. And again, once they get the thing implemented, they're not going to reverse it. Okay? This is how it works. You're not going to vote your way out of this. You cannot let it happen to begin with, because once it's implemented, you will not reverse it. Even if it's against the will of the people, they don't care. Show me one instance where people are voting themselves out of these problems or out of what these globalists want to do. And so again, here's just a little sampling. So 2020 to 29, this is referring to automobiles. Development of petrol diesel engines ends. Any new vehicle introduced from now on must be compatible with absolute zero, whatever that is. You can look that up in the paper. It's like 60 pages. Referring to vehicles again, 2030 to 2049, all new vehicles are electric. Average size of cars reduces to 1,000 kilograms. That's 2,200 pounds. Well, the unintended consequence of that is traffic fatalities will go up. We already know that. 2050, road use at 60% of 2020 levels. That's almost cut in half. Through reducing distance traveled or reducing vehicle weight. Well, we already know they're going to re how they're going to reduce distances traveled. They're going to corral you up into these little 15-minute cities where you're going to work, live. You're going to be like a medieval serf. You're going to be born and die within 30 miles of where you were born. And everything that you need to do to be a consumer and serve the globalists, you'll be able to do in that little sphere. And you'll take, you know, public transport to go wherever you need to go. And you'll be happy about it. They even say it in the paper. It'll be great. This is talking about airline travel. 2020 to 29, all airports, this is in the UK, except Heathrow, Glasgow, and Belfast close with transfers by rail. 2030 to 2049, all remaining airports close. 2050, no air travel at all until they talk about electric airplanes. If you, when those become, then we'll allow you to travel. So no more trips to the south of Spain, no more junkets to France from the UK for the weekend, no going to Cyprus, you're not going to the Maldives. No, you're not doing that. You can take a train and go to, you know, the ocean, like the people back in the 18 Victorian times did, wherever they used to vacation on the UK. Or you can take a train over to Europe, an electric train. I'm just telling you what these folks are shooting for. And again, this was sponsored and financed by the UK government. Here's another thing just about agriculture. They talk about the fact that, you know, animal husbandry is a major cause of climate change. So what they have planned for you by 2050 is beef and lamb phased out by 2050 and replaced by greatly expanded demand for vegetarian food. Electricity supply for food processing and storage will be cut by 50%. And so when you start to read this paper, the first thing that struck me is this is nothing more than just central planning run amok. And we know that central planning doesn't work because they tell you, well, You might think if you're reading this that this is going to destroy the economy, but no, you don't understand, reader. You don't understand, citizen. Because we have to increase electrical production by three times to electrify everything, that's going to create economic growth. And the more windmills and solar panels, because they're not going to build coal plants or natural gas plants or, God forbid, nuclear plants, it's all going to be renewables and battery storage. This is going to create tremendous economic benefits. You know, when you build new houses or your gas furnace goes out and you replace it with a heat pump, look at all the economic activity this is going to create. This is right out of Gosplan in the Soviet Union. I've talked about that before. This is central planning run amok. This is the technocratic class slave relationship, where you have this connected, well-connected, insular, globalist, technocratic class of government officials, royalty, media people, and academics who are smarter than you and don't have any problem telling you that, and they're going to dictate how you're going to live your life. And again, once they implement the regs, it'll be very difficult to reverse them. So this, I suggest you take a look at this paper because I found it fascinating. And the fact is this is what they want to achieve. I mean, you saw that horse face, Jacinda Ardern, who left the news, she resigned as Prime Minister of New Zealand. Well, these people don't just go away. They're like bed bugs, right? If you chase them away from your bed, they just go crawl off into the baseboard and then come back out at night. And so where is she now? Well, she's working for Prince William or Prince Harry, one of these dipshits, inbred monarchs over the son of Charles, the one that's the good one that stayed there. I don't know what his name is. He's got some foundation where they give awards out or whatever for people that are saving the earth, whether it needs saving or not, and she's going to be a board member there. So these bed bugs never go away. They just recirculate. If you do what the devil wants you to do, he will continue to reward you. So yeah. I'm not going to get on the soapbox. So, who are these people and where do they get their money? This is right off the paper. It says UK demand for energy-intensive materials is growing, driving increased emissions in the UK and abroad. The name of this organization is UK Fires. Fires means something. Future industrial, something, resource efficiency. I don't know, something like this strategy. It says UK Fires is a research program sponsored by the UK government, aiming to support a 20% cut in the UK's true emissions by 2050 by placing resource efficiency at the heart of the UK's future industrial strategy. Well, I would tell you before you sign on to this, because it all sounds good on paper, that you should read Vaclav Smil and other people when they talk about, you know, energy use and the fact that, you know, Mark Mills is another one. And what you need to understand is that if you want to use less energy, then the standard of livings have to go down. You either need less people or the same amount of people using considerable less energy. And that means lower quality of life, because everything that you now enjoy and take for granted is all supported by constant and increasing energy inputs. That's it. And if you take those energy inputs away, you can do that if you have less people, or if the people that are still here use considerably less energy. That means, you know, you're not going to go on vacation. Like I said, you're just going to be like a medieval serf, consumer that consumes corporate food, corporate services, corporate whatever. And these corporations are all endorsed and tied into the government of these inbred monarchs. And like I said before, or this, you know, the pointy shoes, the masters of the universe. Okay, the Jacinda Arderns of the world, they're going to come out ahead. They'll be flying around. They'll be going to the Maldives and Cyprus and the south of Spain, but you won't. So you should read it. You should take a look at it, because these people are playing for keeps, and they're never going to stop pushing. The problem is most people of goodwill, who are most working people and normal people, they just don't have the time to devote themselves to this. So what happens is what you see in France, which you're not seeing in the news, where, you know, the people there are fed up. They have a, you know, I think it's BlackRock or somebody trying to take over their pensions and raising the pension age and all this. And this is what you have: massive strikes, chaos and disorder, and things like that. And then that's what you have to resort to. Again, is Macron meeting with these people? Is he backing down? No, he flew to China. He's trying to be the big man on big diplomat to bring try to get him and Ursula flew there to try to get Xi Jinping to intercede and, you know, bring a diplomatic end to the war in Ukraine. He's not dealing with his internal crisis that he has. You're not going to change this by voting. You're going to have to, hard men are going to have to go in and deal with this. You can infer what you'd like from that. So if you think you're going to be the last gazelle at the water hole, you're not. That last gazelle gets eaten by the crocodiles too. You're going to have to make a choice. Now, many people listening to this, they're all for this. I think this is going to be great. John, you don't know what you're talking about. This is a better future. This is what we, okay, you can have that opinion. I don't want to live in a dystopian, fascist, corporate, technocrat controlled world. It's just not going to be pleasant. And what's going to be interesting is the rest of the world's not going to go along with this. That's going to be part of the bifurcation of the multipolar world. The rest of the, if you want to use less energy in the West, the East and South, global East and South will just use that energy. I've said that all along. You want to use less petroleum in the United States and Europe, more will be used in India and China. That's all. And you just have a lower standard of living here, and they'll have a higher standard of living there. That's all. And if you want to change it, you can have all, they just had an election. They keep throwing these people out. The woman in Finland just lost, but the people that took over, they're all for the war. You know, they want to keep supplying Ukraine with weapons. Giorgia Meloni, she was, you know, I saw Marine Le Pen at a function recently, a picture of her. She had a Ukrainian flag pin on. These people are all the same. You're going to have to go in and wipe out that entire political class and start over. Okay? That's what it's going to take. These people are, if they do back down, it's just for a small period of time. They'll come in and pick the trash up. Everybody will calm down. And then it's always two steps forward, one step back. But over the years, they always seem to push the agenda forward. So that's all I'll say about it. Here at Actionable Intelligence Alert, we realize that we're not policymakers. No one cares what we think. It doesn't matter what we think. We try to assess probabilities and see and determine what we think will happen in the future, and then take advantage of it as best we can in order to make sense of the chaos and make sense of this in order to take care of our families and be prosperous and help ourselves to be protected against this nonsense. So that's our goal here. We don't, I don't give any hope for political changes and common sense. That's just not the way of the world. So there's still opportunities. I was talking to someone the other day. Well, what are you doing? Look, there's always opportunities. There's always other places that are more free or less free than some areas. You know, my relatives came to the United States. I'm going to make a prediction. I made this prediction and it's off the wall. It's not going to happen in the next year or two, but it's already starting to happen. Especially if you're Orthodox like I am, you already know this is happening. There are communities in places like Russia, which is the largest and probably most pious Orthodox country in the world, where foreigners like from the US and other places are moving, creating Orthodox communities. South African farmers that were displaced have been invited to come to Russia and set up, you know, bring capital, bring their human capital and regular capital and begin farming there. And I think that some of these countries, you're going to see before it's all over with lines at, you know, consulates as people try to get out of the West as it continues to implode. This is your future if you're in the West and worse. So I'll leave you with that happy thought. But again, you know, our relatives, for the most part, unless you're of native stock or First Nation stock, everybody was an immigrant here. And so things change over time. Now, I don't anticipate all this happening in the next year or two, or even probably in a generation, but this is where we're heading. Okay. And things always change. Change is the constant. So we'll see. Whoever thought that El Salvador would turn into the what it has turned into now? I mean, you have fresh government there. They locked up all the MS-13 people. You can go watch the YouTube videos. It's a totally different country now. And it's starting to, people are starting to go down there. And as more human capital comes in, the place will improve. It's amazing what can happen when common sense policy is put into place. Okay, I'll leave you with that for this week. If you're interested in gold stocks, you might want to check out this, the Actionable Intelligence Alert newsletter, because we have, I think, a way to play it that gives you the upside, although gives you a lot of downside risk. Okay, guys, that's it for this week. We'll talk to you next week.